everyone, and welcome to History in Technicolor. And this week we've got Wolf.
Me.
And we've got a guest, because weirdly enough, Wolf and I decided we needed somebody here who knew what they were talking about. And so we've got Glenn. Say hello, Glenn.
How you guys doing? Thank you for having me on.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. Or hopefully it's going to be a pleasure anyway. It might be rubbish, but yeah, I'm sure it'll be rich.
David,
this is bad.
Anyone other than you is a pleasure.
You're a very rude man. Okay, Glenn, but we invited you on because you know all about Robin Hood. And in fact, I think we had a chat some time ago. So what we're going to do here, folks, is I'm going to introduce, and then we're going to go through three movies. So each one of us has picked a movie. And the idea here is that, as we did with The Witch, we're going to look at the myth around Robin Hood. And we're going to think about how the films relate to those myths and whether they're good movies and which is the best. And then we're going to decide which is most faithful to the myth and which is the best movie. And then at the end, we've got some challenges. And I'm going to tell you the challenges right now so that as you're listening to us burble away, you can think about these questions, okay? And when we get to the answers at the end, you can shout them out. We won't hear you, of course, because this is a podcast, but you can do that. Okay. So one question is, who would you cast as Robin Hood? Okay, that's Glenn's question. Wolf's question was, if you made a new Robin Hood production, which element or elements of the myth are absolutely vital for you to consider it a worthwhile Robin Hood adaptation? As normal, Wolf's question is the most complicated. And then my question was, excluding the man himself, don't quite know what I meant by that, which character in the Robin stories would you be? So,
include Robin.
Don't include Robin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because everybody would be like, I'm Robin, obviously. Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. If either that or they would be Spartacus. Okay, so we're going to start off with Glenn telling us something about the background and the myth. Glenn, over to you.
Quick mythology overview of Robin Hood. Robin Hood has always been a rebel that's in the north of England. It's never moved around. Now, the forest has moved from Barnsdale to Sherwood over time. But the basic premise of it is that he is fighting against usually a tyrannical regime, which is why in the earlier legends, it's Edward II, because a lot of people had a problem with Edward II, even though his only real crime was ineptitude. Since then, because Richard the Lionhearted became such a popular figure, it has moved to where he was a steadfast servant of Richard the Lionhearted, and he was fighting against John, who was also a bit of an inept person. Robin he's typically displayed, or more commonly displayed, as a yeoman, if you were to look at everything historically. If you're just doing 20th and 19th century stories of Robin, then he's almost always nobility.
Added in the 20th. I was wondering when that came in.
Yeah, as the story got older, it became more important for authors, apparently, to feel that they needed to make his sacrifice greater in leading these men against, you know, a tyrannical regime.
Interesting.
Right. So if he has more to lose, then it's a better story, essentially.
And Glenn, just out of interest, from the little bit of reading I've been doing, is it correct that he didn't always rob from the rich and give to the poor until sometime later in the myth?
No, actually, that is a very 20th century adaptation. I have been, as far as I know, Errol Flynn's movie might be the first one to really do it, but before that it was done as a play. But it definitely came about in like the late 20s, early 30s, during the Depression.
Oh, that's really interesting. So previously he was just a bad man.
Well, previously it was usually done actually. It's like King Arthur's legend. You know, if you read the original King Arthur, he's just a psychopath.
Right.
But he's our psychopath. And that's kind of Robin, yeah, to a degree. Although more often than what you might believe, Robin Hood is a comedy of he's an inept moron, but the sheriff is slightly more of an inept moron.
Interesting.
Otherwise, though, the frequent trend is actually that he's, you know, the last vestiges of Saxon nobility or, you know, Anglo-Danish nobility against a Norman regime.
How interesting. So when was that theme? Because, of course, Walter Scott produced that theme, didn't he? But was that theme there before Walter?
That would go back to the Basically, that would go back until they started writing plays in the Elizabethan age about him. That's kind of, I mean, they might have changed Norman to whatever, but that was kind of how they dealt with what, in the North, they never really enjoyed being ruled from London. So that was kind of how they dealt with it, was that Robin was, whoever was their oppressor at that time, Robin was fighting against them.
Very interesting. I did not know that. Because, of course, one of the myths that is parallel, as I understand it, is the myth of Eustace the Monk. And I'd already understood that Eustace the Monk was different from Robin, because Eustace is actually quite a violent man who, in the end of the story, gets his comeuppance from the forces of the law. This is it's a Northern French myth, and his historical figure is Eustace. And I'd always understood that Robin was basically always a good man.
Well, yeah, but you have to remember, you know, the definition of good man changes over time. I mean, you know, example for Americans, George Washington's a good man, but he owned slaves, so he wasn't.
Yeah, but in the sense that at the time, or in the story, he's a goodie. He's on our side.
I would say it'd be better to describe him more often as sympathetic.
Right, okay.
You know, normally when he becomes outlawed, it's because either a clergyman was about to rape his sister or his wife, and he kills said clergyman. That is the most common depiction of Robin becoming outlawed.
Okay.
And then from there, he kind of wages his one-man guerrilla war, and he slowly gains followers. I mean, Adam Gord, I think the name is, right? Was the outlaw legend that or fable that actually predates Robin Hood.
Right.
And you know, that's where a lot of the confusion comes from, is because we don't know of Robin Hood that has survived what was originally established as the Robin Hood myth and what was adapted, because the other one has basically been forgotten.
Right,
and
understood.
In some depictions, they just kind of say that Robin met up with him and took over his gang.
Right. And you were saying just before we started that he might be traced all the way back to Harrowwood the Wake now, is that right?
Yeah. So, like I was saying before we started, they didn't, you know, the first written Robin Hood is in the, you know, I think it's the 11th century, early 11th century. And that's the first historical time we know somebody wrote down the story. Well, presumably, if somebody took the time to write it, that means that it was an oral legend prior to that, because nobody ever had an original thought.
That's so true. Certainly true of this program.
Right, yeah.
Speak for yourself.
And then you get left to answer the question, so, okay, when did this begin? And then you end up with, again, past outlaw fables like Adam. And anyways, one academic paper, I think it was done out of Kent State of Ohio, traced it from, you know, saying that it was most likely from Hereward, who was a Mercian folktale, basically, but
East Anglian, surely.
Oh, I thought it was Mercia.
Okay, he was the Isle of Ely, wasn't he, Hereward? Anyway, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, that's where they traced it back to, because Hereward was essentially an anti-Norman folk tale to get behind, and that would be about the time that the North would also have a story that was anti-Norman, because, as you may well know, William the Conqueror was not pleasant in the north of England.
He was not. Harrying of the North.
There's also, you know, the same theory, though, that would have gone back to the Danish occupation of Northumbria. But as far as we know, the Danish occupation of Northumbria was not that violent. I mean, it was, but it was no more violent than any other kind of settlement slash light war of that time would have been. It was just raiding. They assimilated more than they conquered, as to where, you know, Billy was like, I'm going to burn and kill everybody.
Okay.
So just to clarify, so that for me and everyone else, do historians think that there was ever an original person that maybe this myth traces back to? Or is it entirely fictional and then just passed on and elaborated through oral history and adaptations, rewrites, theatrical productions, etc.?
So the best way to answer that would be to say, was there a Robin Hood or a Robert Hood or whatever? Probably yes. As far as what we can safely say was from him and what has been, you know, fabricated, no way to tell, to the point where you can say everything in the Robin Hood legend and myth is exactly that. Whatever grain of truth there was has been long since forgotten and coded, and we'll never be able to find it. So basically look at it like King Arthur. Like, we assume there was somebody or somebodies like King Arthur, but we have no idea who or what exactly they did. And it's the same with Robin Hood, really.
Okay, so I put together a tripometer.
Okay.
A meter of tropes, okay? And I had these down against which we can measure our films. So arrows, is that always a trope? Okay.
The archery is the very first thing. Honestly, what's weird is when they started making him a swordsman. That angered a lot of people at the time because he was supposed to be a yeoman.
Yes. Okay. Rich versus poor. So we've found that's a variable one. Saxon versus Norman. We've found that's a bit more complicated, but that's kind of there. Anti-clerical. And it sounds like that was a trope originally, or it has been.
Yeah, that's the whole reason, actually, for Friar Tuck's induction into the story is to show the fat clergyman that's kind of, bumbling, silly comic relief.
Right, okay. Nobleman, so that's, Robin Hood being a nobleman. Actually, that's a more recent acquisition, you're saying, but that was a trope. Merry men, are the men always merry?
Well, Little John's the one that proclaims them merry men, but that's been part of the story for centuries now.
Excellent. A jolly hero, normally lighthearted.
That would definitely be more of a 20th century trope.
Okay.
So this shocked me slightly. I was reading about the ballad about the Guy of Gisborne, and after Robin defeats him, he decapitates him, slashes the remains of the head up so that no one could recognise him, and then dresses up, I think, as the guy, and then pretends that he's killed Robin Hood to sneak into the castle.
Bit bloodthirsty.
I think he's like on a pike, and I was,
right.
And I was like,
this isn't Robin.
This never happened in the Disney version.
Is that, yes. I think that's the one, too, where he assassinates another nobleman and kidnaps a noble lady, isn't it?
Oh, I'm not sure. Oh, that sounds like the Robin Hood we don't know.
We don't know, yeah. And then the last trope I had was there's always a Sheriff of Nottingham or a Guy of Gisborne type opponent.
Yes, that would be that goes back to the beginning.
Any other tropes I should have listed?
Just to check, so are we saying that it takes a long time before... I know that King John comes in as a villain kind of later on, but was there always a king who was oppressing... the country at the time, even if the main villain was still the Sheriff of Nottingham, etc.?
It depends on the format that the story is introduced, because literature was so much shorter for so long. Oftentimes it's very much like, okay, my problem is the sheriff or it's this clergyman. But when they would do more of a broad overview, so like when plays and, longer format storytelling really came into style, there would at the very least be the mention of the king.
Okay.
But because that took maybe 2 or 3 centuries, that's why we're kind of left guessing that the Robin Hood legend originated during the reign of Edward II.
Okay, this is great. We have now taken 3 times more time than we said we were going to take. So
no, it's important. This is really, it's a good start.
This is really important, but, I don't want people to, feel they have to open a vein when they're listening to the podcast. Right, because that's a bad thing. Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, Glenn. Now, the first movie, Wolf.
The first movie. Okay, so a point that I wanted to make to begin with, and I haven't verified this, but I would imagine that it is accurate, is that there have been 112 movies, at least, about Robin Hood since 1912.
I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Like an undershot.
I looked it up on Wikipedia, too, and it's enormous. It's absurd.
The amount of different variations that keep happening, there's a lot of interesting stuff out there with Robin Hood. And I think the key point about this is that we're only going to touch on a few movies, but it's being continually adapted and is going to be for... presumably forever, as we kind of want to retell the story over and over again for new audiences. So I thought I would begin with The Adventures of Robin Hood. I've selected this film because I believe that it sets the benchmark for all Robin Hood adaptations. It's the most influential and thus potentially the version that most adds to the myth, or at least cements it in our understanding. It also helps that it's very fun and a genuine landmark in Hollywood cinema. So The Adventures of Robin Hood was made in 1938. It was a star vehicle for the very successful Errol Flynn. Its director, the incredible and very prolific Michael Curtiz, had previously had great success for the studio with Flynn in Captain Blood and The Charge of the Light Brigade. He made hundreds of other films over his career, including Casablanca, White Christmas, and Mildred Pierce. Olivia de Havilland was also the fellow star of Captain Blood and was a regular collaborator who combined to make this a box office draw. There was already a Robin Hood feature, which was kind of in audiences' minds, and that had been made in 1922. It was a silent film starring Douglas Fairbanks, and it had done pretty well. The 1922 version was the first motion picture to have a Hollywood premiere, which took place at Grauman's Chinese Theatre. But this new version of the 1938 one would quickly eclipse it. And at the time, it was reported to be the most expensive film Warner Brothers had ever made. Interesting. Story-wise...
It was over $2 million in budget, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. And you can tell.
Lord.
You can really tell. Story-wise, the year is 1191. Richard the Lionheart is in the Holy Lands and then gets imprisoned by Leopold of Austria. He leaves his friend Longchamps as regent, but Prince John is obviously plotting to take the throne with the help of Sir Guy of Gisborne and a series of Norman barons. And then Saxon nobleman Sir Robin of Locksley comes out to save the day.
Ooh.
So I won't go too much more into the plot because we don't really need to. It's got a lot of the elements that we know about. So I'm just going to kind of talk about the film as it was. It was a massive success in almost every single way and is still lauded today. It ranks very highly on sort of the AFI's like greatest American films list. And I think it's been filed away for preservation due to its importance.
Yes.
It's splendid and is genuinely very entertaining. I think the cast are perfect. I think Errol is effortlessly charming. He's a natural star. Plus, he has this really perfect movie laugh that he's developed. You might find it annoying, but you have to admire his talent for producing the same laugh every time.
No, I mean, I've been really patient. I've been patient, but the laugh, you're not going to try and put the laugh. I mean, the laugh's appalling.
At least it represents the time and how acting was carried out and how the industry was working. Like, it fits in with the period.
Fair enough.
Olivia de Havilland is an excellent foil to Errol's bravado. She delivers sharp-witted retorts and put-downs. I particularly enjoyed the one where she goes, "What can a Saxon hedge robber know about charm or ladies?" She's very strong, and I think she's more than a prize or just a love interest.
I mean, that's it. That is a fair point to, you know, to yes. be honest. You know, I mean, you know, what could a Saxon... Anyway,
and we've got the great Claude Rains as a very villainous Prince John who takes such delight in his evil acts, while obviously Basil Rathbone strikes his kind of dangerous poses and deliciously and powerfully and dastardly sets off on all these missions that he's going to do. I thought, and you can kind of, because it's Basil Rathbone, I've not said a single, I know, I said a single word right. I can picture him whispering his plots into John's ear and it being very, a bit like the snake in the Disney version. Mm. I can really see him being the most mischievous and kind of dastardly villain you could come up with. The production design is absolutely tremendous. There's lavish sets. It's clearly brought to life by the Technicolor filmmaking. And I think at the time that was still relatively important and new. So it really gave the audience everything they wanted, which is probably why it goes so heavily into the bright colours.
Right.
It's very...
The colours are amazing. I mean, the colours are absolutely astounding. It was...
There are all these huge sets and they're packed with extras and animals, mountains of food, fantastic stunts and fight sequences. The final sword battle is very impressive. I thought it was far more enjoyable than the sword fight at the end of the Kevin Costner 1991 version.
Pshaw is all I have to say at this point.
I would have to agree with the pshaw.
Well, I was going to say, as David might say, this film has left me both swashed and buckled. I did want to note that I really enjoyed the stunt where he's holding onto the rope and he cuts it to drop the gate and then flies up to land on the ledge above. It's so clearly happening and is real, and there's no safety. It's remarkable. The score was made by an opera composer, Eric Wolfgang Korngold, no relation to me. He's wonderfully romantic. It's wonderfully romantic and sweeping. And from the first moment, it kind of perfectly pulls you in and lets you know what you're going to get. He won an Oscar for the score, and due to his influential early film scores, he's often considered as one of the founders of film music, reshaping the industry up until now. I think he was definitely one of the biggest and most prolific kind of composers in the real world who then went in to do scores for cinema. Mm-hmm. I thought it was also worth noting that I thought the film was very funny. Very entertaining and charming. I enjoyed the Sheriff of Nottingham when Prince John says to him, "Have you tried to stop him?" And he goes, "Yes, but I couldn't find him." And I thought that Bess was this scene stealer who arrives quite late in the movie, starts churning up the scenery. There's this the back and forth between Robin and Will Scarlet when Robin's talking about how wonderful it is to live in and like sleep in nature, and Will's always like, "But an owl hooted in my ear." It's not for everyone, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite funny. I can see the progression of how this was being delivered as theatrical plays for everybody, and I thought it was really, really entertaining. I will ask your opinions before I say a bad word about it. Glenn, what did you think?
Glenn.
You're right. The Errol Flynn one, it's beautiful, especially when you consider that it's over 80 years old now. The Errol Flynn one is responsible for a couple, like, historical inaccuracies that make me cringe. But aside from that, the movie itself, it's definitely, I would say, the second best Robin Hood. And you can't deny that it's the most influential, because that's the one that paved the way for all of the 20th century and 21st century now reincarnations of the character.
What are those couple of historical inaccuracies that make you cringe, Glenn?
Well, let's see. The first one is he's supposed to be a Saxon knight who's the best archer in the land, so that already makes no sense.
Uh-huh. Fair point.
He also carries his arrows on his back, which makes even less sense, because you wouldn't do that if you were in a fight, because you'd be costing yourself precious seconds grabbing arrows. They'd be on your hip. Oh. But that's, I mean, you know, that's really minor in the thing, but it's one of those things that bugs me.
Okay, well, we're getting the measure of you now, Glenn, because, you know, those are sort of the level of inaccuracies that probably wouldn't even register with me, I must admit. You're a stage above us, so I'm impressed with that.
Glenn, just out of interest, he uses black arrows in the movie, but I haven't yet to notice that in other versions. Is that just in this one, or does that exist other places in the myth as well?
Well, I mean, historically he would use ash tree arrows, so I'm not sure if those would be black or not. My understanding is that they used those at Warner Brothers because they picked up better on the film.
Right. It makes sense, because, I mean, ash wouldn't be black, even though you make ash fans, you know.
Because I thought it was interesting that he seemed to use black arrows at certain times to send a message.
Impressive.
As if he was like, something evil has happened, I need to fix this, I'm going to send you a black arrow so you know.
Interesting, that's the advanced course, I'd have said,
So I'll be honest, I don't know if any, I know messages through arrows have been a part of the story, I don't know that they've ever been, you know, painted black or whatever to show, like, oh, something big's about to happen. That would be something worth looking into on my end.
It's like the black spot from Treasure Island.
Indeed, or indeed, message for you, sir. Concord, sweet Concord. Anyway, I'd agree with some of that. The thing actually that you picked up on, which I think has most resonance, is that idea of the theatrical play. And you can imagine this being, you know, not history as dry, accurate facts. They wouldn't have had the arguments back then about that. They'd have just said, here is this great story. You know, it's the kind of thing you could see happening in a Lord's Hall with a bard singing, you know, or enacting it out. But surely it really hasn't aged well, has it? I mean, if they made this now, you'd open a vein. There's an unacceptable use of wimples. There are wimples all over the place. And, you know, one wimple is one wimple too many. The laughter is agonising. Yes, I mean, what's his name? Alan Dale? I mean, you know, just needs to be shot. Now, you know, no questions asked.
It's just unwatchable.
I would say you could make the argument that any Robin Hood movie made is very much a victim of its time. They don't age well.
Yes, Robin Hood is so... Why is it so successful as a trope? And it's so successful because these factors are infinitely adaptable to the time. So, yes, I mean, I withdraw myself. Obviously, you know, it's fantastic. It's colourful, big sets. It's ambitious. As you said, it defined the sort of genre. But I did find it agonising.
I think for modern audiences, the kind of the iconography of Robin Hood comes from this depiction.
But he seems to follow very closely Walter Scott. So the Silver Arrow, all of those tropes, the Saxon versus Norman thing was a big Walter Scott thing. It felt like this was the thing that I heard about, certainly from Walter Scott. This is the thing I heard about when I read all those Ladybird books when I was a lad. You're absolutely right. They were all the Errol Flynn version. I thought that Errol had picked it up from Walter, but you're thinking it's probably the other way around.
Well, even if he did, I think, I mean, it's the first time it's really brought to life visually. Yeah. And then once you see it... they kind of combine, yes. And that's what it looks like from now on.
Yes, I don't have to struggle at all to say, right, this is the myth of Robin Hood. Great, okay, so we like it. You two like it a load. I'm a bit more cynical because
I thought Will Scarlet was terrible. He just follows around, and it's almost like Sir Robin from the Holy Grail, and he's just like the musician who follows behind him.
Terrible.
You run into that problem with a lot of the movies because it is meant to be an ensemble cast. It's very hard to do each character justice. And unfortunately, Will Scarlet or Much the Miller's son are usually the ones that either get severed entirely or just neglected.
Yeah.
I will say one last quick thing about the 1938 Robin Hood movie. That is the one that made the steal from the rich and give to the poor. Because it did so well with that theme, they continued that through the communist scare, which maybe doesn't mean a lot to very many people, but I think that's fascinating, because that's essentially communism. You know, that's Bolshevikism to a T. Like, we're going to take the rich people's stuff and give it to the poor people. And the fact that that trope survived McCarthyism to me is worth something of an academic look.
Okay,
that's good very point. Interesting.
Very interesting. Anything else you'd want to add before we move on?
The only thing I was going to say is when I went back and rewatched it because I hadn't seen it in so long, the newer movies had made me think more about The Sheriff of Nottingham. Probably it's just the Kevin Costner version and Alan Rickman. So I had to kind of figure out what was going on because Gisborne was obviously the main villain. But then through my research, obviously, I learned that he's been around for a really long time in the stories. Am I correct, Glenn, that he maybe could be traced back to appear at roughly the same time as Nottingham, if not even before?
Guy? He was slightly after the sheriff was established as the main villain, but Guy was always brought into the story to be more of a direct nemesis. So, like, the sheriff was supposed to be more of the overarching big bad, and Guy was supposed to be, like, the first-tier big bad.
Interesting. Okie doke, shall we move on to, obviously, the best of the Robin Hood oeuvre?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, so, why this movie? I'm going to take you back. Imagine you're in Maidenhead. Maidenhead, Glen, is a little suburban town outside London, a sort of feeder town.
Why would I be in Maidenhead?
You're in Maidenhead.
Okay.
Two young lovers are sitting in a theatre in Maidenhead, watching, for the first time, Robin Hood, Prince of Thebes, with Kevin Costner. They're loving it, they're watching it, you know, very much in love, very much in love. There's the bit where the Celts invade, Robin is away, and the Celts, evil Celts, one of whom was actually in an advert for Quick Fit at the time, but never mind. The Celts arrived, and they charge down, and they're killing everybody in the forest. And then, just when you think it's all terrible and they're all going to die, Robin Hood comes, swings in and saves the day, and the young lovers threw their hands in the air and said, "Hurrah!" And then realised where they were. And that is why I'm choosing this Robin Hood. Because the young lovers, you will not be surprised to learn, were Jane and I. And we were transported by this movie. And when I looked back at some of the reviews, I thought, are we thinking about the same movie? I cannot understand. So there's one here which said, a mess. A big, long, joyless reconstruction of Robin Hood legend that comes out firmly for civil rights, feminism, religious freedom, and economic opportunity for all. Well, first of all, joyless? We were in heaven.
Like good things to me.
And second, the other things, yes, exactly, sound all jolly good. Why are you complaining
about
that?
It is quite long, though. They do have a point.
It is quite long. Anyway,
well,
so that's
a Kevin Costner movie in the 90s. Kevin Costner was known as the four-hour movie man up until about 2002.
That is true. I mean, he could have done Dances with Robin, couldn't he? And then where would we have been?
You know.
Anyway, so that's one reason I chose that. I've only gotten to the choosing bit. Sorry, I do talk a lot. So Jane, David, Maidenhead, because I love it, because it's got the greatest, or one of the greatest comic performances of all time within it. And because, although they don't, people will not admit it publicly, everybody in the Western world loves it. They say they don't, they write bad things about it, they talk about Kevin in his accent, but if you get them in a small room and ply them with alcohol, they will tell you this is their favourite Robin Hood.
Really quick, about the accent, can we just address the fact that nobody has any idea what the English accent would have been during the time that Robin Hood takes place in?
Indeed, and it may well be that the vocabulary of the Americans is a good deal closer to the vocabulary of the English of the time, because English vocabulary has moved a lot more than American because of their contact with Europe.
Yeah, there's the whole thing that Shakespearean actors, they didn't say autumn, they said fall, and they would have sounded more like Americans. So I'm wondering what they would have sounded like in Nottingham. But anyways, continue.
Indeed. So I like you, Glenn, I banish any worries about Kev's accent. As far as I can say, it was never a problem for me. So, directed by somebody called Kevin Reynolds, who I'd never heard of.
He made Waterworld!
Did he? Oh dear. Okay, screenplay by people I'd never heard of. But there's a great song, isn't there? Everything I do it for... come on. You know, what more do you need? Brian, who apparently...
Suddenly very hot in this shirt. My, oh my.
It's getting a bit steamy, Glenn, in here. We might have to call you back. Just great stuff. There's a lot of really good actors in it. It has Brian Blessed. Brian Blessed! There is no bad movie with Brian Blessed in. Is that not true? You cannot make a bad movie.
Brian Blessed is a phenomenal talent.
He is.
Blackadder is all I have today.
Ah, exactly. What else do you need? Very quickly, the story has got a lot of the tropes of Robin Hood, but also it's got some other things that Robin Hood didn't have or has added. So Robin is away in the Holy Land. He's estranged from his father. He cut his father's lands of Locksley, he's a sort of minor nobleman, and his lands are taken away from him, and his father is killed. He comes back, he's sad about not being reconciled. He ends up in the forest because he doesn't like that and he makes trouble. There is Marian, is the embroiled local lady running a manor. She's under pressure. And the evil sheriff of Nottingham is trying to gather money for King John, and his mum is a witch, and I think they're kind of trying to make him king or something, and there's a nasty cleric in it who tries to marry poor old Marian. This is not making a lot of sense, isn't it?
Is the witch Morgana?
Which is called Morgana, but there's no... I mean, only because I think they're trying to throw a link to Arthur. There's no real link ever between these two. She is Geraldine McEwen. She was quite interesting. So she's not being Marple, and she's decided to be a witch. Actually, I have to say, I think the witch bit was the worst thing in it. So
I was trying to eat my lunch when she spits into the blood.
Oh, that's gross. With the sound of the nails.
Yeah.
That's boring. So why, as a film... Great theme tune. Morgan Freeman, well, this is what made him great, wasn't it? You know, who'd have heard of Morgan Freeman before Robin Hood?
That's fair. I mean...
Is it actually?
To me, anything Morgan Freeman does is already worth, like, an asterisk. Like, oop, that's worth a rewatch.
Absolutely right. And he was fantastic in this. He was everything you wanted him to be in terms of that character. It's swashbuckling. There are arrows all over the place. It's a fantastic bit where Kev shoots two arrows or something and he takes with his teeth, he rips the feathers off at half side and he shoots it and they go in two directions.
I did keep wondering, if he keeps ripping the feathers off, why did he put them on in the first place?
Well, no, because he wants to do two and they want to go different directions.
I see.
And then there's the one where you've got the arrow coming straight towards you.
And it's on fire.
And it's on fire. God, that's so good.
But did you not wonder why... He fires the first arrow and he can't split the rope.
Is that right?
So he has to fire two arrows. This is the greatest archer of all time.
Yeah. Oh, Picky, Mr. Picky.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you know, shooting a rope in two pieces with an arrow is not easy.
No. Yeah, right. Mr.
and greatest archer of all time, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that he could, you know, have pinpoint accuracy. That just means that he didn't miss often.
Good point, Glenn. Good point.
I mean, it's not really a quibble. I think I'm just... They'll show him splitting an arrow earlier on, which is designed to be, like, almost the most perfect shot. So then when he has to save the day, and young Wolf...
He's nervous. ...is
hanging, he just catches the rope just a little bit. And I was like, I thought it might slowly break, but he barely touches it.
Tension, Wolf, tension. Marion is properly romantic, and she's great. It's got an edge of patriotism around it without being the sort of rather overblown thing of the 1938 movie. And then we come to Alan. We come to Alan Rickman, and...
Shut up, you twit!
I'm going to gouge out your heart with a spoon. Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings, and call off Christmas! Superb stuff. You upstairs. You, 10 minutes. Oh, I mean, it's just... You know, a bravura performance, loved it. So Little John was great. So there's humour throughout the thing. Little John in the castle scene jumps, smacks a few guards around, sits next to his wife. His wife said, "Hello, my lover." I mean, it's just, you know, it's full of joy and love and all the rest of it. As a historical record, close to the myth, it's got the social justice Rob feeds Rich thing in spades. It's got Richard versus John. Interesting, of course, most rebel legends are essentially very conservative in nature. So although we don't like to make them that way now, we want them to be radical. In fact, back in the day, they're about the re-establishment of social order, not the overturn of it. The people that are fought against are people who are doing something different. And in a sense, this is the way this is. The baddies are people who are overturning the right way of things, which is that Robin has his lands and that Richard is the king and so on. The men are merry in spades. Bit miserable to begin with. Robin comes and makes them merry, which is great. Anti-clericalism is an old trope that reappears because you've got the fat clergyman. And the anti-clericalism, as I understand it, always used to be against upper churchmen. And so you have the friar, who, of course, is a mendicant. And he's Friar Tuck, and he's a good guy. Little John, quarterstaffs, fantastic. And it's really well done. Anyway... there are newer tropes, so there's the Crusades and Azim, which I think is relatively new. We've got Will Scarlet, which is probably one of the weaker bits in it, and, you know, him being the illegitimate brother, although it adds a little bit of personal story, which is very often absent. You know, Robin is often a rather cardboard cutout character. At least he's got a family. The witch,
and
I thought...
Christian Slater.
That is, yeah. Christian Slater. Who is Christian Slater?
He's a relatively famous actor.
Has he done... What else has he done?
Oh! I thought you were asking in the movie. I was like, he was Will. Christian Slater was in The Heathers.
Okay.
He's usually a bad guy. He's in Archer now a lot.
Right.
I don't know. I can't really think of anything huge that he's done, but he's got that, like, cadence.
Right. Okay. Right. Never heard of him. So I love Kevin's 80s scarf and his bouffant
and hair. His hair, yeah.
Yeah, love that. It's absolutely delightful. The witch, I think, is a bit of a rubbish bit, but anyway, there you go. So there you go. And why would I recommend anybody go and see this film? Because it is a hoot from start to finish. I rest. Comments?
That's a good case.
Thank you.
First of all, Kevin Costner is my surrogate father, so I will always defend this movie.
Excellent. Excellent. I mean, you're quite right, Glenn, you know.
And then really quick, I was just looking it up while I was curious. So the movie made, according to Wikipedia, $390.5 million in 1991. Which today would translate to over $700 million.
So that's all right then, is it?
So yeah, he did pretty well on a $48 million budget, and I think the cinematography for 1991 is amazing.
Right, fantastic. So you're all in favour, Wolf? I feel there's some grit in the oyster that is the history of Technicolor here.
No, I have some interesting things to say.
Okay.
It should be clear, and I've already mentioned this once.
By the way, we'll be the judge of that.
Okay. This film will always be in my mind because it was the first and potentially only time I have ever seen a character called Wolf, other than the one from the TV show Gladiators,
in
a movie. And as a kid, noticing that sort of when I was... I can clearly remember watching it sort of around sort of 6 years old, maybe, with like all the family. Seeing that connection, that was the first time, and I was like, my ears pricked up. I was like, crazy.
Crazy.
He's in it quite a lot. And it wasn't just mishearing.
The little lad. Yeah. See, he's quite cute, isn't he?
So,
he's good.
I always appreciate it for that. I think it's really fun. I have really fond memories of it. But I do think with repeat viewing, as you age, it does deteriorate.
It gets a little bit better every time. Oh, it does have weak geography. I'll give you that. The geography is weak.
Interestingly,
this is the only one that I'm aware of that was actually filmed in England.
Is that right? Interesting. They do go to Nottingham via Hadrian's Wall is the problem.
I see.
Yeah, they don't have a firm grasp on where things are.
No.
But to be fair, the Sheriff of Nottingham wouldn't have been very concerned about Loxley, seeing as Loxley isn't in Nottingham, so...
Okay, fair point. Anyway, Wolf.
But wasn't that because their boat just washes up and they don't know where they are?
No, it's because they want to film something in that beautiful dip in the Hadrian's Wall. Lovely spot with the tree.
I think it does a lot of really good things. I think humanizing Robin way more than a lot of the others do. He actually has a character in this, which I will admit he doesn't really have in the Errol Flynn version. Also, he's a little bit more fallible. He seems to make mistakes in this movie. There's real threat and he actually might not make it through. He might not be the hero everybody wants him to be. He seems to make bad decisions and the people do pay for his involvement in this. I think that's a really interesting idea to add that in, and I think it works. Kevin Costner's very enjoyable. He's at the peak of his career. Some of the dialogue is a little bit clanky. Like, there's the old blind man, and he goes, "He fancies you, my lady. I'm blind, but some things I can still see." And I'm like, come on, we already know. You're not just sitting in the boat, old blind man. We already know they fancy each other. You don't need to tell us.
Hey, he's just playing along, though.
Nottingham is obviously really great, and I think that it's defined by Alan Rickman, really, more than anything.
He does kind of steal the show, doesn't he?
And it's really kind of tongue-in-cheek and fun, and it's hard to complain about that. It just can feel a little bit old now, and some of the changes to the story, the more research I've done, I don't know, just seems interesting how they want to make Will Scarlet such an important character with his capturings and then his, like, kind of double crossings. And
I must admit, the Will Scarlet thing I always thought was...
They had to do that because they had gotten Christian Slater. He wasn't going to do a role where he didn't have meat.
Right.
I understand you don't know who that is, but to people who do, they're like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, he is relatively big, and he was getting bigger at the time.
Yeah.
And Alan Rickman, sorry, Wolf, but Alan Rickman actually turned down the role twice until they said, you can do whatever you want.
So did he? Is that right? Interesting.
So all of that comedic timing and all the greatness was all him.
Huh.
The only point I was going to make is that sometimes the makeup looks like it's Holy Grail dirty makeup, where everybody looks like they just get wrapped up in a bunch of shawls and just have a little bit of mud shoved on their face, and then that's done. I just keep thinking about the old man.
Yeah, well, I keep thinking about his scarf. I mean, the scarf did make Kevin look as though he'd just come out of an 80s disco. I mean, you know, it was sort of... It didn't look very authentic.
Yeah, costumes-wise, because I guess we're going to come to this. So now we've had two movies. Which one has more accurate costumes? Because one's very 90s, and then obviously one's very kind of theatrical.
Yeah, I mean, the theatrical one is, you know, something. Actually, the only thing about the 1938 one is that in medieval movies, by and large, the colour is taken out of movies, which is very inaccurate when you're talking about the nobility. So wherever the nobility were gathered together, it would be a riot of colour of all their pennants, because it was all about show was nobility. So there is some veracity. I mean, not quite to that extent, the 1938 movie, but there is some veracity about that. A common inaccuracy is that people leech the colour from medieval movies.
So are we suggesting that in this version, maybe Robin chooses to kind of have, like, models?
I would not make costumes one of the triumphs of this movie. Certainly when the Celt, the guy from the Quick Fit advert, comes over the hill trying to make look like a Celt, he's got some sort of furry hat on that really you just think, okay, you know.
I think putting the Celts in this movie in general was the biggest error that they made.
Yes, I think that was probably a faux pas.
The witch tells him to do it in the first place. Mm. It's such a weird...
It does actually pick up, funny enough, on a 17th century fear in England of armies being brought over from Ireland to support the king in the Civil War. And maybe they just picked up on that in some way. I don't know.
I'm not entirely sure. I feel like they were trying to do too many, like, obscure references to old myths because, you know, there is... like little tiny references to like pagans in Barnsdale Forest. So I in my mind, that's what they're doing, but right. Maybe that's just a coincidence that there's anything.
Right. Okay, great. One more thing.
Quick points. I was going to say, I believe that Morgan Freeman's character, the Saracen, what's interesting about his arrival is that I believe that there was a TV version that was made, which yes. introduced a very similar character. And then the actual makers of this film thought that that was part of the myth because they'd seen that version. And that was partly how it was incorporated. And they used the same character name. And then they were told that it would be copyright because it wasn't a mythological, right. like a character that existed before. It was just for that version. So they had to change his name from Nasir to, I think it's Asim.
Yeah.
But I think that's just, when we're talking about how myths carry forward, it's interesting that somebody saw one version and transposed various things from it and put it into this.
Some of the greatest things in the world come from incompetence.
And then the only other point I was going to add is, which I think is interesting because it led me to a fascinating Robin Hood movie, Sean Connery appears at the end as King Richard.
Are you going to talk about Robin and Marion?
Yes, I was going to mention Marion, Robin and Marion, where he plays
that is
Robin
a movie.
Hood.
That is a movie and a half. Have you seen that? Oh.
No, I haven't seen it, but what seemed...
Oh, that's a real movie.
The cast looks great.
It's heartbreaking.
But what's interesting about that is, I was reading how much the movie represents Richard in a really negative light and how Robin fights back against Richard. And it's one of the first kind of Robin Hood movies to not play up to that mythology where Robin is kind of this natural servant.
Who is it
Richard.
That plays opposite Connery in that? Is it?
Oh, it's Audrey Hepburn, isn't it?
Audrey Hepburn. That's right. That is a terrible movie because you're waiting for the bit, you know, the swashbuckling bit. And the Sheriff of Nottingham and Robin, they're both tired and broken and old, and they've been through all the things, and they're kind of wearily trying to accept each other, but Robin cheats and kills the Sheriff by sort of... I mean, it's... Oh.
And then they Romeo and Juliet each other.
I mean, it's agony, it really is.
Anyway, I just thought it was interesting that he cameos at the end as King Richard, but he had previously played Robin.
It's a very good movie, what's it? It's painful. Okay, so we've wept up enough about Ord and Sean. And so we come to the third movie. Over to you, Glenn.
All right, so then we've got the 2010 Robin Hood movie starring Russell Crowe, or is Rusty, as he's known to his friends.
Is he actually?
No, that's just what I call him.
Oh, okay.
But we're friends. So
he speaks very highly of you, actually, Glenn.
Yeah, he doesn't say a lot of nice things in general, but I'm one of the few.
Excellent.
But it was directed by Ridley Scott, same producers as Gladiator, and I think that is incredibly evident in this movie that there's a lot of Gladiator, like, stealing from, basically. Oh, and Kate Blanchett plays the female lead in this movie, which I thought was interesting because neither one of their stars are actually English. But yeah, so this movie is in some ways the most historically accurate movie, but in very small, like, details that they paid. You know, they actually do have Robin as a yeoman, which to me is great because that makes the most sense. They have the accurate-ish version of King Richard's death. They do a, you know, in the very short depiction of King Richard, they do what seems to me to be a fair one. And on top of that, they weave into the movie the bits of the 20th century legend that we all know, like, you know, the nobility and the Sheriff of Nottingham and all of that that everybody knows and identifies with, while trying to keep it somewhat in accordance to the, you know, 11th, 12th, 13th century retellings of the story. My favorite bit actually has nothing to do with the plot. It's just where they're all eating, or after they're done eating, they're all kind of like conversing, and there's rats that are clearing from the table. Because I'm like, that's brilliant. That would have happened, and nobody ever does that. But aside from that, I mean, the movie has... Oh, it also has Mark Addy in it, who is a great Friar Tuck, but it has a lot of problems, too.
Mark Addy is a great Friar Tuck. So why did you choose the movie, Glenn?
Well, I chose it because you chose The Prince of Thieves, and I didn't feel like watching the 1938 one.
Is that right? Okay, so you didn't go for Men in Tights, though?
Well, yeah, I mean, Men in Tights is fine, but it doesn't bring anything new to the legend. It's just a spoof on Prince of Thieves. And the Disney one, you get into a whole other side argument about what is Disney. And I think we're going to talk about that very briefly at the end, so I won't go too into it now.
Okay, so you chose it for Demir.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fun film, but if you were to ask me to rate the movie on 1 to 10, film-wise, it's a 5. historically accurate, it's maybe a 6.5.
God, you're already marking. That's early. That's great. Okay, so you're quite underwhelmed about it. I mean, you've already done.
Yeah, the movie has it's entertaining and it's action packed and there's a lot of fun stuff that happens and a lot of nice little like homages to the legend. But overall, the movie, it's top heavy. They do too much, I think, with Robin Longstride. That's Russell Crowe's character. They do too much with his daddy issues, and frankly, by the time they do the big reveal, I'm sick of it and I'm over it. And I think that it's a good thing that his dad left him because he's a whiner.
You know, it's interesting. So I'm going to kind of basically agree with you. I mean, the thing I really loved about this movie, and really loved about it, and therefore by the end, when I just wanted to open a vein, you know, felt slightly bitter about it, is because the realism thing, the thing that Ridley Scott's tried to do to really put it in the time, is fantastic. I love the Richard I. I love the interplay between Richard I and Robin, how it's sort of jokey, but then Robin goes too far, and so he gets put in the stocks. You know, it shows Richard as Richard would have been, a big, bluff, arrogant, there's no social equality here, pretending Richard's this kindly bloke who loves the poor is just, you know, doesn't dislike the poor, but they have to be in their right position. So I loved all of that. And the start, I remember thinking, looking at the start and thinking, this is going
to
be brilliant.
They try to make Richard too much like Henry V. So I do like that part of it. It seems fair.
So all that's great. And then Kate Blanchett is brilliant. I think she's great. And that bit of the story is kind of good. Mark Strong is a fantastic villain. I love Mark Strong. But then it's so English radical stuff. So it's the same. It's trying to transpose this story into a 21st century context of social equality and social justice. It's, you know, it's your Mike Lee, Ken Loach, Ridley Scott tradition of, and it makes it pompous. It makes it over sort of portentous. They're trying to sell this big message about freedom and liberty and all the rest of it. And it's just too serious, and the plot's a mess. King John's good, yes, though, isn't he? And Isabel of Angoulême is rather gorgeous, isn't she? Sorry,
King John.
I'm dribbling slightly.
King John to me is the bright spot of the movie as far as acting is concerned. I mean, Cate Blanchett did a great job, and Marion, I think, is probably the best person from the, you know, the side that we're rooting for. I think she's done the best. But I think the guy that played King John knocked it out of the park.
Was it Oscar Isaac?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He was very good. He was very villainous, volatile, changeable. You felt genuinely panicked. William Hurt was all right as Marshall, presenting a solid, you know, good Marshall. It's just the sum of the parts is less than the parts.
William the Marshall's always done as this great man who's enlightened beyond his time. And, you know, but yeah, it was a good part for that role.
Yeah.
And am I right that Mark Strong's Sir Godfrey is essentially the Guy of Gisborne? Because that's what he seemed to have said in interviews.
I don't know. I'm not
sure why they didn't just make him Guy of Gisborne, but it took me a little while because when I was watching it, I was like, who the hell is this supposed to be?
Yeah, but, I agree.
Yeah.
And do you think they just changed his name because they're trying to build this mythology where they're altering Robin's identity a little bit and they're kind of changing all the characters just slightly to maybe make them more, I don't know, real?
Yeah, maybe that's it, to sort of snap you out of just wanting to see the same old thing. That's an interesting thought, yeah.
And I mean, yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some research that I'm unaware of that says Guy wouldn't have been a name then, so they just changed it entirely. I think, if anything, Ridley Scott was just too clever by half for that.
It has kind of got that, but I take Wolf's point that if you want to represent the Robin Hood myth, actually selling people a bit of a dummy and changing the name so they don't fit into the old pair of slippers that everybody knows is not a bad strategy.
But then at the same time, since you can kind of readapt Robin Hood as many times as you want, it seems almost unnecessary. Like, we could kind of keep a lot of these people like as we understand them to be and still give the same depiction that you want. Also, do we think that they were building up to possibly make another movie in the future?
Yeah, they seem to be, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be one in the trilogy, because that movie, to me, the biggest crime of the 2010 Robin Hood is that it's an origin story, and that's fine, but they should have marketed it more as an origin story, because he's not actually doing the things that you associate with Robin Hood yet. It's more about how, you know, a returning yeoman from the Crusades becomes Robin of Locksley and then becomes Robin of Sherwood, essentially.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, and I think they were going to make, he was then going to be Robin, wasn't he? Yeah. Anything else you want to say about that movie?
The main thing for me is it's too serious.
Yeah, it's too serious.
It's they're trying too much to be Gladiator, and Robin Hood doesn't need to be grim to be effective.
Yeah, exactly. And the more I've read about the way the story's been told for hundreds and hundreds of years, is that it's there for kind of mass entertainment, and it's a little bit light, and everybody gets involved in it. It just seems a shame that this version is so deadly serious all the time.
Yeah, it's just heavy, isn't it? Okay, I think that's great. So we're now going to come to the last bit, everybody. Well, no, we're not going to come to the last bit. The first bit we're going to do is we are going to rate these movies. First of all, we're going to rate them as a movie, and then we are going to rate them for their faithfulness to the myth. Okay?
Okay, so
Are we ready?
With the myth rating one, we might need to refer slightly to Glenn on this.
Yeah, indeed, we might. A little bit. Glenn will pretend that we're listening to you as the all authority. In fact,
we'll All right, fair enough. Right away.
Okay, so 1938, the film as a film out of 10. Wolf.
8.
Glenn.
7.
Oh, come on. Okay, I'm going to go 6.
Okay.
We're all in the same ballpark here.
Yeah. I just kind of felt I was forced into it. It's a myth. Faithfulness to the myth?
I mean...
3, maybe.
Interesting. Faithfulness to the myth? Because I was going to go high on that.
No, this one creates a lot of the myth that we associate with Robin Hood. So in that essence, yeah, absolutely. But as far as, like, sticking to the source material that had come out prior... It's, you know, it goes all its own way, and that's great because you can do that with stories, and that's why, you know, something like Robin Hood lives on for an extra 80 years after it's been made into a movie is because they were able to tell their own story. But if you're assuming that the myth is what's already existed, then it didn't follow it very closely at all.
So even when you take Walter into mind...
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll put that at maybe a 4 then.
So, Glenn, a couple of quick side points. Is there always a battle where Robin faces Little John on the river?
So, typically he does have to face off Little John. That's how he earns the respect and trust of the Merrymen.
So, and that has existed for quite a long time in the myth.
Yeah, if it's not Little John, then it's somebody else. It's not, you know, there's a couple depictions where they just sort of hit it off, and Little John sort of falls into place because Robin has battlefield command, but even that is only because they have to face a foe together. So if it's not Little John, then, you know, it's Huntsman or something along those lines. But more often than not, it's Little John over a river on a bridge.
Okay. And then was there always an archery competition, or was that created in this film?
That... was, I believe, actually created in the silent film, but that's a 20th century thing.
I see.
There is the May Day competition, which is what it's referencing.
Yeah.
Which was during the, you know, Tudor and Victorian era, and that was as an homage to the myth of Robin Hood. So you could make that argument, but as far as the archery contest being part of the story, that's not a thing up until the 20th century.
Okay, so that doesn't come from Walter Scott?
No.
Okay. So you're saying 4, and I think I'm going to have to fall in with...
Yeah, I think we follow Glenn's advice on this.
Because Glenn knows what he's talking about, and we don't. On the quality of the movie, I'm going to concede, go back up to a 7 out of 6. That's being a bit mean, wasn't it?
But I think it is interesting that we think it's accurate because it was so influential.
That's true. Fair point. Right, so Kevin, so this is me... the Kevin Costner movie, so it's out of 10, yeah? Yep. So we're going to say around 432, 433?
What's the real score, David?
That seems like a low ball.
I don't know that you get better than this. I don't know. I mean, okay, it's not Lawrence of Arabia, so we're going to have to go 9.
It's fair.
You're appalled, aren't you, Wolf? You're appalled.
I would go for 9.
You're going to go for 9? Wolf, just say what you think.
I would go with a 7. And that 7 is because of nostalgia and fond memories and the fact that it's very enjoyable.
Okay, just give it the score you want to
give. No, I'll give it a 7. I would give it a 7.
You really wanted to give it 2, didn't you?
That is all fair, because if you were to show that movie now to, you know, somebody that never saw it, they'd probably be like, what is this?
That would be quite interesting, actually. We must do that. We must find somebody off the street. Let's go and nip and find somebody. Sit down, watch this movie.
They'd have to have not seen the movie, though.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, and myth-wise, Glenn, we're just going to look at you again here, I think.
So this one, again, probably around a 4 or 5. It adheres to a lot of the myth established by the, you know, Errol Young version, or Errol Flynn version. Sorry, I went to school with a kid named Errol Young. But he had nothing to do with Robin Hood.
That's good to know.
Yeah, but it does adhere to a lot of what's been established prior in, you know, the film genre, so I'll give it, you know, 2 thumbs up for that. But again, as far as sticking to source material that predates Errol Flynn, it's a little all over the place, and based on the fact that I don't think anybody did any research before making this movie, anything that does, you know, make reference to or pay homage to something out of the myth, I'm almost going to have to call a lucky coincidence.
Right.
So do you think we should actually mark it lower than the other one because of adding in the witch, adding in the Celts, the seemingly reckless
There's a certain recklessness.
The Celts heard it. The witch, though, because I can't be certain that it was a happy coincidence, the witch is somewhat of a tie to things that were mentioned in other Robin Hoods when it took place in Barnsdale.
Okay.
I mean, the Wall of Hadrian has nothing to do with Robin Hood, so I'm not going to count that for or against it, unless we're doing a geography score.
Yeah, yes, geography score is very low, somewhere down in the minus 200s, you know.
And Robin coming back to a ruined home and a blind father, or blind father figure, I should say, isn't, you know, that is in there in various places.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
So
yeah, that's not something that they made up. That has existed before. Okay.
So when did it enter the myth that he went and fought in the Crusades? Because that arises more frequently now.
Yeah, that's more of like the play telling. So, you know, around the Elizabethan era into the Stuarts is more when they decided that, you know, what is was obviously during King Richard's era, because, you know, nobody ever said anything bad about King Richard. So it was easy to make him somebody that you would root for when he was backing up a king that you'd love. And especially during the Stuart era, anything that they could do a subtle dig at the Stuarts, they would.
Excellent. Well, which is fair, obviously. Oh, well, hang on. Sorry, you're absolutely right. We haven't finished off the previous discussion about historical actors. You're saying 4 or 5. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, plus 2, really quick. You do have the thing where it has nothing to do with the story, but where Morgan Freeman delivers a C-section. Like, that is an amazing bit of historical accuracy that has nothing to do with Robin Hood. So, like, little things like that are what make me keep it at even-ish with Errol Flynn.
Okay, next. Okay. Russell. Talk to us about Russ.
So, yeah, Rusty Crow as a movie, it's, you know, maybe a hard 5, pushing a 6. Mythology, actually, now that we are considering, and history, now that we're considering what I've given the other 2, I would say it's a 6 would be more fair. 6.5, maybe, if you were feeling generous.
We're always feeling generous here in the shed, Glenn. 6.5 it is. So, film, Wolf?
I was probably going to give it a 6.
Okay, I'm going to go along with the I'm going to go along with the 6 things. I love the realism at the beginning. It'd probably be a 5. Okay, great. So look, we've scored it all. That's great. And the winner is Kevin Costner. Woohoo! That was only one result, wasn't there? What about the Disney movie? Very quickly, what do we all think of the Disney movie, Glenn?
I loved the Disney movie as a kid. That's what actually sparked my interest in Robin Hood. Later, when I found out that they only made it about Robin Hood as a last-ditch, like, Hail Mary, I thought that was hilarious, because they were originally going to make a quick, you know, kids movie that was playful about the trickster Reynard, who was, you know, French-Germanic trickster fox.
Uh-huh.
And then as they started to write the screenplay and kind of develop it, they realized that Hitler had used Reynard as Nazi propaganda. and Disney did not want to be associated with that, so they decided Robin Hood right before they started doing the motion capture.
Wolf, Disney, your thoughts?
I think the main thing to talk about is the fact that Peter Ustinov as Prince John is absolutely incredible.
The world has forgotten about Peter Ustinov. We used to love Peter Ustinov.
He's such a mummy's boy, and he keeps sucking his thumb and having these tantrums. it's just incredible.
And we loved him. For me,
Beautiful. No, I was going to say, that's a beautiful bit of the movie.
It is. For me, it was two things. I didn't see it as a kid. So there are two things. I rather liked Alan O'Dale, the rooster, and is in Nottingham. And then he sings Robin Hood and Little John are running through the forest, having such a good time with the sheriff's men. I love that bit. And then there's Jane's favourite joke, which is, ooh, ooh, your lady in waiting's waiting. She loves that, don't know why. And then it was the first movie that my kiddies, when little, could turn on by themselves without me having to get up out of bed at 4:30 in the morning. So one morning we were lying in bed and I heard
we're listening to the whole thing.
He's just showing off that he can whistle.
And that was one of the happiest moments of my life, because I did not have to get out of bed and look after the little buggers. It was great. So,
and a lesson on parenting for all. Thank you, David.
Okay, fantastic. Turn on my video and leave me alone. So, right. So we've got some questions now. Who would you cast as Robin Hood? Glenn.
Did you guys ever watch the Shameless in the UK version? The one that played Carl.
Don't know him.
Elliot, I think his last name is Tittensore. He's from Manchester.
Right, so you'd go for Grit.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, he could hit, you know, in that show, he was comic relief for years, and then he got kind of more real as it went on. So he showed that he could act. But, I mean, I would just go for somebody that I felt could do both, you know, comic relief when needed and action, and wouldn't look ridiculous as an actor.
Very good. Wolf?
Okay, so I had a couple of options, and none of them quite worked. I'm thinking about star power as well, so we have to make this as a movie. So I considered Ewan McGregor when he was younger.
Okay, nice choice. Yeah. Ewan McGregor.
And if I was going to kind of think about making this film in the future, I would actually consider Tom Holland, who's playing the young Spider-Man at the moment, in sort of 5 to 10 years, because he has this star presence. And he can probably do all the stunts, and you can work through all of that. And he's very bankable. I really think
he's too short. I have big problem with the hero being less than 5'8". I know, it's a me thing, I know, but it bugs me.
Okay, he'd have to be much the middle.
I just thought he'd be so merry.
Right.
His Spider-Man has got the right amount of like quips, and he's really good when he's in these fights. And if you're going to make Robin kind of that classic Merry Men type figure, I think Tom Holland could kind of do that. Alternatively, I guess the other one kind of kicking around, and maybe everybody'd say it, is Tom Hiddleston might be a bit serious though, wouldn't he?
Maybe
he's quite dry humour, so that could come across.
I was going to go for Kenneth Williams, but maybe that'd be a bit too camp.
Right.
I think he could make a bit. Well, maybe
little John.
But then, I mean, obviously there are probably two obvious calls that neither of you mentioned. One, Tom Cruise, because essentially Tom Cruise is brilliant in everything. And then Chris Pratt. What about Chris Pratt?
Chris Pratt would actually be a really good casting for it.
I did consider it.
He's come out of nowhere as a big action star as of late, and he's got the chops.
Could be human, but chops. Okay, great.
I would cast Ralph Fiennes as the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yes, he could be very good. He'd be very
really sweary Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yes, he'd be very good. Right.
Rowan Atkinson will be the Sheriff of Nottingham in my version.
Who would
say? Rowan Atkinson.
That'd be very good, following the Alan Rickman approach. Right, TV or cinema, you ask, Glenn. Better as TV or better as cinema?
I think it works better as a TV show, because I think it opens it up for more long-form storytelling. When you have a movie, they always try to do too much. I mean, look at the more recent one, the Taron Egerton one, which nobody saw. So
yes, I haven't seen
about it. But the fact that nobody saw it tells you all you need to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you go back to 2010 Rusty Crowe's version, they do too much.
Yeah.
I think the BBC version with Jonas Armstrong, while incredibly corny and campy, but like that, I think was a much better medium to tell the story.
Both?
Yeah, I would agree. There seems to be so many different stories that when we say there's like new interpretations, sometimes they're just kind of different elements of the story being brought to life. And it was being told over so many kind of generations in all these different like iterations. And I just think that maybe TV gives you that opportunity to explore the world and give all those, that wealth of characters, that kind of involvement that you would get. So it's probably quite episodic. It suits that medium.
It, I must admit, it's got lots of stories within the story. I'm going to disagree with both of you and say it's possible. Because the film, they've made very successful movies out of it because you can just sell it as a short, you know, play that type thing. Or, yeah, you can expand it and really go into it. I think the wonder of it is its longevity. And its longevity is because the themes are as relevant now as they've ever been. And I think it works in either iteration. Okay, vital. This is Wolf's question, I think. What is vital to the myth? What do you have to have in there if it's going to be a Robin Hood movie?
Well, I mean, you definitely have to have grade A archery. And I think now, if you're going to do it in any time in our lifetime, he has to steal from the rich and give to the poor, regardless of the accuracy of that. But that's what people are going to see it and recognize as Robin Hood. Aside from that, I mean, you know, you definitely need to have Little John and Maid Marian, but I think you could probably honestly axe a lot of the merry men and people wouldn't care.
Okay. Incidentally, Izzy's just texted me to say that we're missing a great Ireland England game. And I have to tell you, Glenn, that when I organised this, I was a fool because Six Nations and it's Ireland versus England. I can't believe I'm doing.
When does the game end?
You know, a poxy two bit, no good cotton picking podcast when England are playing Ireland at rugby.
When does it end?
Well, I don't know. But you're.
Let's hurry up then. Let's hurry up then, David.
Right, your go. Vital to the myth.
For me, I think.
You don't have enough time to explain rugby to me.
No, we'll have to do another podcast on that in a couple of hours.
I think that you could get rid of the majority of the characters and it wouldn't really have a huge impact, especially because you could make a composite character out of some of the others. I don't even think you necessarily have to have one particular villain. It doesn't have to be King John or Nottingham or Gisborne. Yeah. But I do think that there should be one tyrannical ruler that he opposes.
Okay, he's got to be a tyrannical ruler. Okay, anything else?
No, I think we've covered everything of great importance.
I would go arrows, rich man, poor man, merry men. I think those are your three elements. So you've got to have arrows. You don't think you've got to have arrows, Wolf?
No, I do. I just think that like we've seen enough versions that...
You could do it without the arrows.
They've increasingly got him to use a bunch of different weapons, so we wouldn't be too surprised if he could wield something else.
Okay, interesting. Okay, the next question was, what character would you be?
I would be Little John.
Little John. Why would you be Little John?
Because he has the most fun, but he also seems to have, like, Robin, someone's always trying to kill Robin. If Robin's there, they don't pay attention to Little John. I think Little John gets to have all of Robin's fun, but kind of doesn't have the same level of threat. Stress.
Right, okay. Good choice, Glenn.
I would be Alan Adale because he can sing and I've never been able to sing.
Right, okay. Hence why you didn't join me in singing the Disney song. Okay, Alan Adale, great. So I'd think I would be Friar Tuck because he gets all the fun. I mean, he gets all the booze and all the nuts. You know, it's got to be Friar Tuck.
All the nuts.
Friar Tuck's the first one to die, though, depending on the story.
Oh,
okay. I'm glad you picked that, David. right, so, and then there was another question.
Basically, we wanted to know, why do we think the myth has developed the way that it has? So I've obviously read some suggestions over time that maybe sort of at least during Tudor England, there was a re-examining of Prince John, for example, whereby he was somewhat viewed as a Protestant martyr. Is that correct in some sense? That some people began to kind of retrospectively reanalyze history.
Would kind of figure. I mean,
and
you know,
Richard became.
I mean, that's the way of historians.
So I just thought that it's interesting, kind of over time, different time periods, we have different views about what certain characters are doing at the time. And if you set it during that period, you're going to maybe align with different elements, or you're going to want to change it so that maybe you aren't supporting King Richard. I find it interesting that we support King Richard in almost all of these versions. Yes. They're always defending the poor, but they're like, yeah, it's absolutely fine that King Richard is off on his third crusade.
Which I think that is why, in the Ridley Scott thing, why they changed that. Because actually they said there, this Richard I guy, okay, they didn't make him out to be a villain, but they showed him as, you know, he's a king, very privileged, you know, all the rest of it. They put that in context in ways that in other movies they don't.
Yeah, I mean, that one, that was definitely a big part of what they were trying to establish, that and the fact that, what was he, king for 10 years, and he spent less than one of them in England?
Which I always find an annoying objection to Richard I. Richard I was the head of an empire, the Angevin of Empire. The problems were on his borders with France, not in Nottingham. And he was a hero to Christendom, which was the thing with which he identified himself, and therefore he went on crusade. Anyway, sorry, you just touched the nerve there, Glenn.
No, I've always agreed with your defense, but yet that doesn't mean that he was a good king. Is all I mean.
Doesn't mean he was a bad king either.
But just because somebody has problems abroad that they're dealing with, you know, he did let England fall into misrule, and he consistently forgave his brother for said misrule.
Well, did he let it fall into misrule? I mean, the problems in Richard's reign are relatively minor, and he has some...
I mean, he came back to a broke England twice, and then they had to raise a huge ransom to get him out of German prisons.
Well, the ransom thing, fair enough, but then that wasn't his fault. Isn't that what we call victim blaming these days?
I suppose, but is he really the victim when he's the one that decided to go gallivant around the world?
He was he could be accused of being slightly unwise and having gone that way. But look at the quick game of Canterbury, for example. Here is a man with an extremely sensible approach to Anglo-Scottish relationships, which a lot of his following kings would have done very well to take part of.
Fair.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're going to have to draw it to a close. I mean, I think... I would agree that I would say that it's the thing we've already said, that it's such a plastic myth that you can update as you go, and that's why it survived, you know.
I will say really quickly, though, when you're saying why did the myth survive, I think that's kind of one of the crapshoots of history, is that it did, because all it really has depicted in its essence is somebody rebelling against something, whether it's, you know, conquerors, invaders, tyrannical rule. And we mentioned earlier Hereward, so he wasn't the first myth to do that, but he's definitely one of two that has survived through the ages. And I think some of that might just be due to the fact that Northumbrians, specifically people in Northern England, latched onto it early on because it was always kind of considered the wild land, so a wild woodsman was something that they could really relate to. And I think that is a big reason why it survived into the playwright era.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. We must stop, but I think I'm glad we've come up with the right conclusion, which is Kevin is great, in brief. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Everybody have a great rest of your day, and go England.
Yes, go England. We won, by the way. Anyway, this is me later, of course, filling you in on the response to Papillon. And I have to say, it was pretty popular. More than I thought it would be, actually. 68% of you loved it, and not many hated it. Though I once again forgot to close the option on Facebook that allows people to add their own poll options, and so you, of course, went and added loads of options. What is it about the culture of rebellion and disobedience? Anyway, Jeff added, I saw it when I was a nipper, but can't remember a gosh darn thing about it, and watch it again. An opinion which was super popular. I put you all down for the not seen but interested category just to demonstrate that crime doesn't pay. Though, hopefully, Papillon already taught that anyway. Memories for those of you who did not rush out immediately to watch it again, a tiny proportion, obviously, were sometimes a bit vague. So Jennifer remembered a lot of sweat, which is, you know, reasonably accurate, actually. Rowena remembers being impressed by Steve McQueen. There's a cue, Rowena, and we don't jump cues in Blighty. In the cue already, there was Claire, who, apart from being a bit jaded about the book, has had the distinction of having lectured Steve about wearing the right footwear. Impressive. Jonathan had the courage to remind me of the key thing about the book, at least, which was where they hid the money, which they sort of gloss over in the film, thankfully. There was a general strand of fascination by the environment. Rex had been there, and it sounds fantastic, though Rex and Steve also raised that rather critical point. Did Charrier just make the whole thing up? I'm bound to say that I think it's entirely possible. It doesn't strike me as the most reliable bloke. Anyway,
Overall, the impression I got from everybody was one of qualified enjoyment, but without anybody going really potty. So no one put it in their top 10 history movies, for example. Last laugh to Don, though. Wolf and I keep debating whether or not we should have plot spoilers, and usually we do, you know. Don tells me that he sat down to watch it with a mate who started our proceedings by announcing, "He escapes." Ah, so good. Anyway, it was fun. Thanks to everyone who commented, and well, back to the studio, I suppose. Okay, that's it. We did this at the end, just for a change of air and scenery. I really hope you enjoyed Robin Hood episode. It was great fun to do, and we'll hear your feedback. Do come and give your feedback, because I'd really love to hear it. Plus the answers to all those questions, of course. And then in 2 weeks' time, we're back again with The Lost City of Zed. So, see you all on Facebook, and see you all in a couple of weeks' time. Bye.
Are you not entertained?